Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 15, a look back from pick to album. Before we begin this week's episode, I just wanted to answer a couple of questions that were emailed to me from Derek and John. I really did enjoy reading your generous comments about the show and obviously the questions. So please, if any of you guys have any questions and you want them answering, please email historyofscotlandpodcasts@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcasts@gmail.com. And I can answer them in any following episode. Now, Derek asked, what were the greatest ethnicities of the people that lived during the Kingdom of Alba? So that's a very good question, Derek. This is very hard to answer due to the lack of evidence that comes from the country at this time. There were no great surveys like there was in England, for example. But with the evidence we do have from both dug-up remains and sources, we can safely say there were a mix of Pictish, Scotto, Delritan, Irish, Briton, Norse, Saxon and Welsh. Got that? They were all within the Kingdom of Alba at this time. Remember, the Kingdom of Alba was formed through the merging of the two smaller kingdoms, the Pictish Kingdom and the Kingdom of Delrita. So due to this, the ethnicities varied from place to place. With the emergence of some of the Saxon kingdoms and then the Viking kingdoms, we start to see communities popping up around the time of Duncan I too, of all different ethnicities. You know, some of these Saxon kingdoms became under the rule of the Kingdom of Alba, as well as these smaller Viking settlements that were housed around the coast. As well as obviously the Kingdom of Strathclyde becoming more of a vassal state to Duncan, we see a greater number of Britons being spread throughout the land as well. In terms of the bigger numbers, I would argue it's probably mainly Pictish and Delrita ethnicities, then probably Scotto to Irish people, then Norse, then Briton, and then finally Saxon and Welsh. Hope that answers your question, Derek. Thanks for your kind comments about the podcast. Glad you're enjoying it. Now let's move to John's question. How long do you plan to tell the history of Scotland for? That is a very broad question, John, and a very nice question. So I think I've answered this in earlier episodes, but I'll mention it again now since you've kindly asked. My plan is to cover Scottish history up until the modern day. So going through the merger of England, the Civil War, the Highland Rebellions, Scotland in the Greater European Wars, such as Napoleon, First, Second World War, etc, etc. So I imagine I will stop well around the first referendum in our time, you know, in the modern era. Although Scotland's history is intertwined with England and Wales, I feel Scotland has many stories to tell in its modern time, as it did back in the medieval times. So really, I don't foresee a real end to the podcast, but I imagine after the Second World War, we'll see less Scottish defining history stories to tell. But again, who knows? Hope that answers your question. Thank you again for your nice words about the podcast. Thanks again to both of you for those questions, and thank you to everyone else for leaving amazing reviews on Apple Podcasts and other podcasting sites. It's been great to see how popular this podcast has become. Now, last week we went through Constantine III, Kenneth III and Malcolm II's reigns, ending with Malcolm II's grandson, Duncan I, coming to the throne. With Malcolm II's death came the end of the Alapinid dynasty, since Duncan I came from Malcolm's daughter and not son. But with this, the change of succession were the heirs and the sons or grandsons of the king, and not any relative was followed, meaning obviously the sons or grandsons were next in line to the throne, and not just any cousin from your mum's sister's sister could take your kingdom. So in today's episode we're going to do a bit of a look back from where we came from as a Pictish Dark Age kingdom to now an Alban Scotto medieval kingdom. I want to go through the changes that happened over the past few hundred years, from the sense of nationality to the European scale Scotland was now being recognised as, to obviously the succession changes that I've just mentioned. After this episode, next week we'll be looking at the common misconceptions of the Dark Ages, discussing what myths and what's reality, discussing the lies that were being told in modern history sessions. Then the following week we'll be starting the House of Dunkeld and Duncan I, two episodes on Macbeth, and then the long reign of Malcolm III. I'm planning on making episodes on Macbeth and Malcolm III longer and spamming multiple episodes, especially with Malcolm III onwards. With this in mind, I've actually planned all future episodes up until August of this year. That's 32 episodes into the future. Believe it or not, these 30 episodes will only cover 100 years of Scottish history as well, before the war with England that we all know about. So they should give you an idea of how detailed into these years we are going to be. So, without further ado, let's take a trip down memory lane and discuss the differences between the Pictish Kingdom and the Kingdom of Alba as it has Duncan I comes to the throne. Now, In the later first millennium of AD, Scotland was a complex and dynamic mosaic of political and cultural traditions where natives and immigrants competed for power and influence, a land of four nations and five languages, in the words of the contemporary Anglo historian Bede. The evidence for the various groups contributing to the development of the Kingdom of Scotland is uneven. However, both in terms of historical sources and archaeological research, it is therefore necessary to consider the broadest possible range of information to reconstruct the period, the archaeology, the history, the place name studies, and art history. They all provide enough evidence to give us a clear picture, as we've gone through in these past episodes. The early medieval period in Scotland can be divided into three major phases that we've covered. Limited evidence remains for the post-Roman phase, you know, around the 5th century AD, which appears to have been a time of transition, when significant cultural changes took place. The early historic or early Christian phase, i.e. around the 6th to 8th centuries AD, was a period of interaction and competition, at least among the elites of four major political ethnic groups. And we also saw the establishment of Christianity as a dominant religion in the area. Then came the Viking phase, 9th century through, and that's taken us to about where we are with Duncan I coming to the throne. Obviously, when a new set of pagans, mainly from Western Norway, disrupted earlier patterns, initially through raiding and later by settling in the north and the west. Their attacks were surely an important catalyst for the unification of the Dalriatic and Pictish kingdoms into the Kingdom of Alba, obviously then going to be called the Kingdom of Scotland. So let's try and split these sections and go through each of the first ones. So we're going to touch on the first one being post-Roman Britain. Unlike southern Britain, Scotland never was incorporated fully into the Roman Empire. Although the southern lowlands were part of the militarised zone between the Antonine Wall, which ran between the River Forth and the River Clyde, and Hadrian's Wall, now south of Scotland's border. Unlike the situation with the Germanic territories beyond the Rhine frontier, little evidence suggests significant levels of trade across these walls, and so with the withdrawal of Rome in the early 5th century, there was less obviously a disruptive nature in Scotland than elsewhere. It is widely accepted, however, that the people between the walls were influenced significantly by the Roman military presence. In fact, with the recognition that the Picts and the Britons both spoke P-Celtic or Brittonic languages, some scholars have suggested that cultural differences between the southern Britons and the northern Picts may have been emphasised, if not created, by the adoption of certain elements of late Roman culture, including Christianity, by the Britons. Several small kingdoms are known among the post-Roman Britons. The people the Romans called the Vatadoni, for instance, appear in the 6th century in the southeast of the Gododdin. In the late Roman period, they were based at the Iron Age hill fort of Trapian Law, which was produced a spectacular hoard of Roman silver dated to some time after. In around 400 AD, this cash is interpreted either as loot or likely a diplomatic bribe or payment for military services. But Trapian Law was abandoned by the mid-5th century, and it appears that the new seat of power was at Dunedin, modern Edinburgh. Excavations in Edinburgh Castle have found evidence for occupation during this period. Whitehorn in the south-east was a site of the earliest recorded Christian church in Scotland, the seat of St. Ninan, reportedly sent to minister to an already existing Christian community. Dating the activity of any post-Roman figure is extremely difficult, owing to a lack of contemporary documents, but scholarly opinion now places Ninan at Whitehorn in the late 5th century. This dating is supported by the site's mid-5th century Latinia stone, an inscribed cross slab with a Latin inscription including the name Latinus, and a six-armed Constantinian Chiro-Christian cross. Little evidence exists for the Picts at this period, as we've discussed in many of the previous episodes when we've been trying to piece all this together. Historically, though, there were enemies of the Romans, allied with the Scotti, or Irish. Archaeology there is strong in the continuity with a late Iron Age culture, particularly in the Northern Isles and the Western Isles. Although there appears to have been significant changes in the settlement types during the late Roman period, understanding of the Picts, however, is patchy. Wainwright's pioneering book titled The Problem of the Picts was written in 1955, and it is only since the 1970s that excavations have made them less of an enigma. If we now touch on the early historic or early Christian period, the Scoti, or at least the Scots of Del Rita, were one of the two groups that first appeared in Scotland during the 6th century, complicating the political picture and contributing new elements to northern British culture. They controlled Argonal, the southern part of the West Highland coast, and retained close ties with their Irish homeland. The other group was the Northumbrian Angles, based at Bamburgh, on the northeastern coast of England by the mid-6th century. The Angles expanded their control over the Kingdom of Godin by the 7th century and over Reget in the southwest of Scotland by the 8th century, leaving Strathclyde as the only remaining autonomous British kingdom. The intrusiveness of these groups has long been emphasised by historical tradition, but archaeology warns against exaggerating the differences among the Brittonic Britons and the Picts, the Gaelic Scots and the Germanic Angles. Despite their linguistic differences, the economies and material cultures of these groups, they were also very similar. All of them relied on mixed farming, where cattle were the most important livestock, as we covered in episode 10. Followed by sheep and pigs, barley and oats were the principal crops. Along Scotland's culverted coast, fish and sea mammals were also important resources. Most people would have lived on the isolated farmsteads or in small, self-sufficient hamlets. There was nothing resembling an urban centre in Scotland until the 12th century. Pottery was uncommon in most of Scotland during this period, and most metal would have been recycled. But excavations at waterlogged sites have produced a wide range of wooden vessels and other organic artefacts. The well-preserved artefacts has left Scottish archaeologists precious little to work with, and the accounts for lack of well-defined chronologically evidence for much of the later prehistory and early medieval period, until the advent of radiocarbon dating in the mid-12th century. The artefacts that are useful for dating, usually because of their wider cultural artifact status, such as the fine metalwork, embroidery, pottery and sculpture items associated with the elite rather than the ordinary members of society. Much early medieval archaeology has concentrated on high status sites such as fortified settlements and religious centres. Although rescue excavations in advance of development or coastal erosion are providing more evidence for the lower classes of early medieval society, it is important to recognise this bias towards the upper class, not only because it is mirrored in the historical sources written by and for elites, but also because these were precisely the people most likely to be defining their ethnicity in ways of advantageous to their own position in the competition for power. Historical, art historical and archaeological evidence illustrates the ease with which northern British elites mixed and mingled in political marriage, alliances and exile as much as on the battlefield, regardless of the linguistic or religious differences. A well-documented example is when the King of the Angles in 592 AD was killed. His sons took refuge in other kingdoms. Oswald went to Del Rita, and Oswo married into an Irish and British royal houses, as well as that of their Northumbrian rival. Another son had reigned as the Kingdom of the Picts as well. All three were converted to Christianity while in exile, although it is reported they have reverted to paganism during his brief reign when he returned back to the Kingdom of Northumbria. And Oswald imported Columbian Christianity into his kingdom from Iona with the foundation of Lindisfarne. It was within these dynastic cross-cultural contexts that the insular art style developed, and it should serve as a warning against the use of simplistic ethnic labels for things as well as a people during the early medieval period. Where the elites were participating in an increasing shared and international connected culture, there are regional differences in the archaeological record, particularly in the settlements. In the south, among the British and Angles, slightly different forms of rectangular post-in-ground timber halls have been excavated on sites such as Dune Hill in the east and Whitehorn in the west, some defended by palisades. Similar forms appear to have been used by the southern Picts. In the west, among the Britons and Scots, are crannogs, natural or modified islands, usually with round timber and wattle houses. These are considered defended settlements because of their water barrier, and examples such as Loch Gasson, were high-status sites. Along the West Highland coast and in Northern Isles, Duns and Brocks, large, round, dry stone structures built in the Late Iron Age were reoccupied, often with modifications, or cannibalised for the construction of more modest cellular or figure of eight houses. Figure of eight houses have been found from Orkney to County of Antrim in Ireland, illustrating the widespread of some elements of material culture. It is to remember that the Picts and Scots were allies against the Romans, and both could have assembled substantial fleet of ships, which would have been used to sail between the islands during peace as well as war. The fort at Birkenhead in the north-east is the largest fortified site of this period in Scotland, and it overlooks an excellent harbour. At least 30 stones carved with Pictish bull symbols were found there, and the wooden framework for its timber-laced ramparts were fastened with nails. The only other known example of nailed timber-laced ramparts is in Dundurn, another Pictish stronghold. Dundurn is a nuclear fort. It has a small citadel at the summit of the hill, with an axis built where the hill is relatively level. Britons and Scots, as well as Picts, used nuclear forts. The type site is Dunad, the capital of Del Rita. Fortified sites such as these forts and crannogs would have been the residences of royalty, and these sites would have produced evidence for specialised craftworking, particularly in the production of fine metalwork, suggesting that smiths worked under the patronage or control of kings and other nobles. The Picts are associated more commonly with a very distinctive art tradition found mainly on stone, the famous Pictish symbol stones that we have touched on in the last episode, such as the Class 1 stones, the Class 2 stones, and the Class 3 stones. If we just touch back on religion for a minute, the expansion of Christianity across Scotland during this period has also been a topic of continuous interest in the historical community. It was Christianity that promoted the literacy that produced the earliest indigenous inscriptions and documents, and even in the post-Roman period, some Britons were Christian. The Scots were Christians by the time they were historically active in Argonal, and it was the Del Ritan that the Saint Columba came into in 563 AD, found in the monastery at Iona shortly afterward, where a lot of the kings that we've been discussing in past episodes are buried. While Columba's life shows him visiting the pagan king of the Northern Picts, there is little evidence for the missionary efforts. Nevertheless, both the Angles and the Picts had adopted Columbian Christianity before those groups switched to the Roman date for Easter, the Angles in the late 7th century and the Picts in the early 8th century. Little structural evidence for churches in Scotland has survived, except for Whitehorn. In many cases, these sites remain in use, and later construction has obliterated the remains of the earliest foundations, although ongoing excavations at Portmonhomic, which appeared to have been a monastery during the 8th and 9th centuries, will provide better evidence for the Pictish north-east. At Iona, part of the Vallum, the bank and the ditch that separated the religious community from the secular world, survives, but the texts reveal that the buildings within were built of timber and wattle, which has left no clear trace. Building churches of wood apparently was part of the Irish Columbian tradition. Although hermits, refugees usually had small round dry stone cells, it was the Roman tradition that encouraged stone construction. In the absence of surviving structural remains, the presence of early churches typically is indicated by the place name evidence, Eccles, names in British territory, and Kill, names in Del Rita. Burials have little to contribute to an understanding of early historical phase. First of all, the acid soils of the Scotland have destroyed most of the skeletal remains. Second, burial practices were quite similar among the different groups, both before and after the adoption of Christianity. Even in the late Iron Age period, the most usual rite was extended inhumation in either a single grave or a long cist, where stone slabs from a rough coffin without grave goods. The only identifiable characteristic for Christian graves, therefore, is their east-west orientation. Some Picts did place such graves under low mounds, with square stone curbs in the early medieval period, but most such monuments are only known from aerial photography, and more excavation is needed to confirm the dates. Now, while past historians cast the early medieval period as a time of war between the ethnic groups for control of what would become Scotland, with the Picts and Dalriton Scots as the winners, archaeology has shown that the situation was much more complicated and has highlighted the ways in which the different groups contributed to the processes of forging a common culture. If there is a large-scale notable trend throughout this period, however, it is increasing socio-politicized centralization. In the Roman period, sources attest to a multiplicity of Pictish tribes. By the early historic phase, there are probably three significant Pictish groups. Hierarchical levels of kingship are evident in Dalrita, with kings of Kincreds, the most powerful of them, being the Overking, and the Overkings of the Scots, Angles, and Picts competing for the position of High King of Northern Britain during the early historic phase. It was only in the Viking phase, as the Norse and their superior sea power annexed the island half of Arngrill, that the bonding of these mainland groups into a permanent and internally complex state occurred. Despite historical uncertainty about the relative power of the Scots and Picts at this time, the Scots moved eastward, and from about 843 AD, as we know, Kenneth MacAlpin and his descendants ruled both the Scots and Picts from the Fort Viot in southern Pictland and to the north of Scotland. Late historical revision makes it difficult to determine what extent this was a violent overthrow of Pictish power as to opposed to assimilation. Nevertheless, by the 900s AD, Dalriton and Pictish vanish from the sources, replaced by an Alba, a nation called by a Gaelic name and used Gaelic language, but with much more of its administrative structure apparently derived from the Picts. From all of this, we can conclude the following five major changes have at least happened from what we know of the Pictish slash Dalriton style kingdoms to the formation of the Kingdom of Alba. A. The Kingdom of Alba had changed from becoming a country with two clear different identities to one national identity, that being Alban or now Scotland. B. The succession laws, although intertwined into Pictish and Dalriton kingdoms, were changed due to the central authority requiring more power and control. The succession crisis that has caused when a king would die, especially with what we saw from the descendants of Malcolm I and Constantine II, was causing division across the country. This needed to change for Scotland to evolve and survive, especially since England had gone through the same process. C. Settlements began to improve with the introduction of Christianity to the country, as villages and towns became a lot more controlled around these religious centres, including the creation of castles for the lords of the lands to settle in. D. The greater diplomacy on a grander scale. Countries in Europe and on the continent began trading and forming talks with the Kingdom of Alba, Scotland, at the time of Duncan I, which did not happen when the smaller countries of Picts and Dalrytons were ruling. We can take this as a meaning of a greater economy within Scotland and more tradable goods to offer, as well as mighty armies ready to go to war for your allies. We actually covered a lot of this in the episode Day in the Life of a Pict, so please check that episode out for more info on that. We'll be doing another one of these around the 13th to 14th century to give you an idea of how things have changed since then. The Scotland we know of today was beginning to form as the Kingdom of Strathclyde became a vassal state to the Kingdom of Alba, along with the giant gains in the north. Considering originally both the Kingdom of Picts and Dalrita were mainly in the Midlands to Lowlands of Scotland, this is a great and giant expansion, but this obviously means the Kingdom of Alba has now caught the eye of the Kingdom of England. The lands coveted on the both sides would lead to many wars that would change the futures for both countries going forward throughout history. The size of the Kingdom of Picts and then the Kingdom of Alba when it merged with Dalrita would have been tiny, with little to no control over the country compared to the centralised authority it is now. So, let's finally close the book on the Picts, Dalritans and Alapinid dynasty. We'll be touching on the Dark Ages, as I said, in a final episode next week. But the dynasty that has reigned over Scotland for this considerable amount of time, the Alapinids, but more importantly, as I said last week, we can now safely say the Dark Ages are coming to an end and the Middle Ages we know of today are beginning to start. The identities of both Pictish and Dalrhetans will carry on throughout the following years. Heck, Gaelic as a language, well, be ready for more pronunciation on those words, both will be eventually replaced with a new identity, this being the identity of Scotland and the Scots, something we can safely say has survived to the modern day. As I mentioned, next week we'll be looking at the common misconceptions of the Dark Ages, discussing what's myth and what's reality. Then after that, we'll be starting in a new era in Scottish history, with the House of Dunkeld and Duncan I. And obviously Macbeth after that, so stay tuned for a whopper of a tale that has stood the test of time. Again, thank you to Derek and John for asking those questions earlier in the episode, and thank you to everyone for the amazing reviews I have been reading. It's been great to see so much interest in Scottish history, and I hope you're enjoying this journey as much as I am. As always, any corrections or issues with the podcast, please let me know at historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. As always, our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and many other great podcasting sites. Please leave any reviews on any of those sites, and I can read your messages in the next episode if you have any questions. Next podcast will be next week as always, probably either before the Saturday or just after, as I have a friend's wedding to attend. But until then, stay safe, have a great week, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. Peace, guys.